For three groups in our population, the times feel out of joint. These are the groups which form our radical right. It is they who throng to the meetings addressed by Clarence Mannion, Fulton Lewis Jr., William Bulkley, Barry Goldwater. It is they who combine in over 1,000 voluntary organizations to disseminate their political attitudes and to affect their political programs. And these organizations vary from small study groups publishing a mimeographed newsletter to gun-toting militiamen prepared to take over those elements of the government which the government apparently cannot carry on successfully for itself, to the well-organized 60,000 member John Birch Society, about whom we have heard so much of late. In their entirety at the present moment, the radical right in the United States numbers between 1 and 2 million adherents. That group of the radical right, which has potentially the greatest leverage on our current policy, I choose to call the Have Bomb Will Travel set. These are the groups, some of whom advocate preventive war, all of whom subscribe to Senator Goldwater's slogan, first victory, then peace. It includes many high-ranking Army, Navy, and Air Force officers and retired personnel who tend to believe that there are military solutions to political problems. This group, as a whole, has no patience with negotiation, with diplomacy. Whenever the President or Dean Rusk or Arthur Dean goes to Geneva or to Paris, they let out a howl. Russia is not to be trusted. No international negotiations can be permitted. What we need in the war, in this Cold War, is not a policy which will permit us to coexist with Russia, but one which will permit us to conquer Russia. How clear victory can be achieved in a nuclear age, this they are not clear about. But that such victory must be achieved, they prate and demand and insist. Writing in a small, typical right-wing newsletter, the Small Business Review, recently a ex-Army colonel wrote, "Why was it that the Heavenly Father allowed us to develop the atomic bomb?" And his answer, "In order that we might judiciously use it to destroy the communist government, to bomb Moscow and Stalingrad, to release the good Russian people from their subjection." This colonel did not ask why it was that the Heavenly Father had allowed the Soviet Union to develop an atomic weapon. Nor did he make clear how the dropping of such bombs on the Soviet Union would prevent tens of millions of Americans from being cindered in the process. But this is typical of the illogic and of the enthusiasm of this group. They want victory. They want the American eagle to release the iron-tipped arrows which she carries in one talon, and they are utterly blind to the olive branch which she carries in the other. Would that they might know the wisdom of the sayings of our fathers, where one is asked, "Who is a hero?" And a rabbi answers, "He who can control his passion." All of us would like to be free of the tensions of this world. But in life, there is no relief from frustration and from problem and from challenge and from crisis. And we must be prepared to live with these, to control our passions, to permit patient diplomacy, negotiation, to ease the tensions of international life, rather than to expect some radical removal, some surgery, which will once and for all wipe the slate clean and allow us to move into the future untroubled. This is not to be, it cannot be. Most but not all of the right wing agree that the Cold War must be heated up. All of them are in agreement in paying enthusiastic homage to the God of free enterprise. In terms of the second of the groups of the right wing, Christianity or the Judeo-Christian tradition are identical with capitalism. I do not vouch for the theology of this statement, but it is typical of tens upon tens of editorials and articles which appear in the over 1,000 journals and publications of the extreme right. And I quote, "Jesus worked with his father in the construction business. Necessarily, Joseph and son were small contractors, and as sober and skillful men, prospered as such. There was no labor union to meddle with prices and wages. Prices were fixed in a natural way, by haggling. The father and son fixed their prices in competition, low bidder to win. Read about the talents and the workers in the vineyards. Business was business in Nazareth, as it is here today. Jesus was a capitalist, preaching a doctrine of individualism, which is the basis of free enterprise." The first commandment of the radical right is this: "Thou shalt not make unto thee any legislation or regulation which interferes with the haggling and the quibbling of the marketplace." The political theory of the extreme right is what I call the theory of an artichoke state. One by one, those in the government must peel away all those rules, that legislation which we have devised in the past half century to protect the consumer, to protect the laborer, to see that justice and equity is done in the marketplace. They would have us do away with minimum wage and hour laws, social security legislation, with public health legislation, with urban renewal, with slum clearance, with all that has been devised of social legislation to protect the mass of the people. No consideration of human decency or dignity, no concern of establishing justice and equity, no passion for righteousness. None of these must interfere with the sacred of holies, the haggling and the quibbling that occurs in the marketplaces of the world. This is their faith, the iron law of their economics. And they see all that interferes with the opportunity of man to be greedy, to make a fast buck, to take advantage of his neighbor, to exploit his laborer. They see all this as some heresy, indeed as some conspiracy which has been devised in Moscow by the Cominform to destroy the will and the stamina and the strength of the American people. The radical right tends to talk in terms of a conspiracy. And they tend to see as conspiratorial all those elements within our population, within both parties of our political system, who are concerned that America shall evolve without economic convulsion, without class war. They mumble under their breaths about such a gentle conservative as President Eisenhower. And many of them call him a dupe and a tool of Moscow. Why? Because he was unwilling during 8 years in office to undo the New Deal and the Fair Deal. They had looked to him as their savior. And he, they say, had sold them out. He had been determined, as are the vast majority of Americans, that the days of special privilege, of tremendous imbalance in wealth, are over, finished, and buried. America is moving into a new era where the good of the and the blessings of our great land are to be more equitably divided among all. And because of this failure of the Republican Party during 8 years in office to deliver the goods, to peel away the social legislation of the past half century, More and more of the groups on the extreme right tend to discount democracy, tend to be fascistic. Democracy, says John Welch of the Birch Society, is a perennial fraud and a sham. A recent article in the National Review of Mr. Bulkley called democracy Satanism. Barry Goldwater, in his political gospel, asked if the founding fathers of the United States intended to create a democracy. And his answer is a resounding no. They have seen that the majority of the people acting through their ballot box, through their vote, have expressed a desire for the doing away with, the undercutting of the underbrush of privilege, which is the legacy of the 19th century. They have seen that both political parties are committed to the justice of this program. And increasingly, they are violent against our normal, moderate ways, against political decision as it takes place in our elections. And they seek by vilification, by pressure, by violence, to achieve what cannot be done in the normal trafficking of political ideas. This, in the long terms, this tendency of the extreme right to discount democracy represents their greatest subversive threat to our way of life. Would that they too had read the sayings of the fathers. But one was asked, who is a wise man, a rich man? And the answer was given, he who is happy in his lot. Not he who has aggrandized to himself a disproportionate share of the wealth of the world, but he who can rejoice in his happiness and in the happiness of others, who will share the blessings of this world, not insist on a monopoly of its material advantage. And finally, beyond the advocates of special privilege and the pugnacious, we have tens of thousands of people whom we can label only the pathetic. We live in times of revolutionary change. Centerville, USA is not what it was 30, 40, 50 years ago. A man must do business with an accountant looking over his shoulder, or with the government looking over his other shoulder. Records must be kept. Labor unions must be dealt with. The schools can no longer be counted on to teach simply the three R's. The pulpit can no longer be counted on to give a rock-ribbed fundamentalist type of religion. The mayor can no longer be counted on to be a friend and not perhaps a hyphenated American whom one would have dismissed out of hand 30 years ago. Imagine Negroes and Jews and Catholics are occupying places of power in our nation. The security of Centerville, USA has been pulled aside and torn asunder. There is a threat of the bomb. The young men must go into uniform and disappear and often come back alien to their culture. Traditional values have disappeared. Hard money is no longer. Thrift, simple honesty, favored prejudices, all these are no longer accepted successful virtues in mid-20th century America. And those who were raised to believe in these virtues, who are now pensioned and aged, who have limited capacities to adjust, find themselves adrift in a society that they no longer understand, threatened by changes which they cannot comprehend and control, fearful that all of this comes about by some gigantic conspiracy of the foreigner, of the Soviet, to gnaw away at what they once thought was the integral heart of American life. It is of these groups that come the elements which insist that only native Christians must be elected to office. It is from these groups that the attacks on the United Nations are most easily leveled. It is in these groups that the conspiratorial theories of Senator McCarthy continue to be given credence. Fantastic theories, not only about claims of Soviet espionage, but theories which involve almost every activity engaged in by our government. Listen to this as typical of the type of material which appeals, despite its patent unreasonableness and illogic. It has to do not with international tension, but it such a simple, seemingly plausible activity as the fluoridation of water. It comes from the Journal of the Daughters of the American Revolution. George Indest Jr., nationally known authority on fluoridation of water supplies, warned that the March of Dimes salk polio vaccine will be administered to 9 million school children by the same association of state and territorial health officers that is knowingly conspiring with the United States Public Health Service in the fluoridation cancer plot. He pointed out that there are so many Russian-born doctors and dentists in our public health service and in the state health offices that it has been commented on in the congressional record. The Surgeon General of the World Health Organization belongs to the World Health Organization, a sort of medical United Nations which cannot be trusted. Parents were warned to keep their children away from the salk polio vaccine. Most parents don't realize that the school children of today represent our Army and Navy 10 years from now. If millions of them can be inoculated, let's say with a radioactive substance that will cause cancer in a few years, why, 10 years from now, the communists could walk in and take over our nation of old men. The diabolic nature of this conspiracy is suggested by William Herstrom, quote, a far-sighted saint in her 80s, who had spiritual discernment far beyond that of most present-day Christians, wrote me stating that the powers of darkness were attempting to dope the drinking water in her city with a poisonous fluorine which destroys the body and mind, and especially the willpower to resist that which is wrong. She was old and feeble, unable to carry the fight to the front. She inquired where she could find a prayer group who could pray for the deliverance of her city. Well, many pathetic human beings are praying today for the deliverance of their city. It's deliverance from the 20th century, from urban society, from the space age, from the atomic age. And there is no deliverance. Only fear. Only tension. Only the opportunity now and again to come with sympathetic neighbors and friends and to applaud those who would turn back the hands of the clock of time. Now, it would be easy for us to say that these fringe groups have always existed on the American scene, from the days of the Know-Nothings and the Yahoos, through the days of the Klan and the Coghlanites, and that the essential wholesomeness of American life has ultimately destroyed the cancer of these extreme groups. It would be easy to dismiss them as ineffectual by virtue of the illogic, incongruity, the falseness of their position and the violence of their attack upon respectable institutions and people. But I wonder if we can, in this day of deepening crisis and revolutionary change, dismiss these groups so easily. I wonder if there isn't something of the radical right in each of us. I have heard you say, I wish the United States would cease to be on the defensive, would begin to adventure more positively, more actively, to attempt some of these subversive activities which are so successful to the Soviet. I heard you complain when we half-heartedly invaded Cuba. You complained not about the invasion, but about the lack of spirit behind it. And I heard you complain also about the scandalous welfare programs abroad in our land. You applauded when the Newburgh program was first put forward. You applauded despite a lack of knowledge as to the facts of the case, which are now patently not as they were stated. All of us are burdened with red tape. All of us would rather not pay our high taxes. All of us are disgruntled by occasional evidence of grafting and of people who take advantage of the welfare laws. But we do not always remember the reason for the social legislation which now exists. or what we tend to dismiss contemptuously as the welfare state. America is the first nation to have moved into the mass age without social convulsion, without class war. And we did so because we were willing to spread the benefits and blessings of our people each year, each decade, further and further down into the masses of the nation. And I've heard you say also, I'm tired and worried by the confusion which surrounds me. I'm not sure how to raise my children. I'm not sure of the philosophy of my schools. I'm not sure of my attitude towards religion. I wish I could hold true to something which was stable, which was fixed. I wish that the virtues and the values and the philosophies of my parents' home were adequate to my own day. I'm confused. And when we are confused, and when we tend to dismiss thoughtlessly the social advantages of our nation, and when we tend to become belligerent with American power, we are speaking the language of the radical right. We have no other solution than those now being adopted, but our emotion has blocked out our reason. We tend to be reacting to the irritants which surround us, and it is precisely when we do so that we become potential converts to this demagogic extreme fringe. And if it is true of us that we, with our religious tradition grounded in prophecy, grounded in principle, grounded in compassion, grounded in a passion for justice and righteousness, if we occasionally block our reason, how much the more so with the non-churched? How much the more so with the vast numbers of Americans who are confused as we are, and perhaps not as alert to the dangers of fascism and extremism as we are. No, I am afraid that if the crisis deepens, if the challenge and the burden becomes unbearable, there is the possibility, as there was in 1930 and 31 and 32 in Germany, that a John Welch or a man of his ilk may seize the moment to win to him the enthusiastic response, the purely emotional response of the many, to attempt what the Longs and the McCarthys in their day attempted, a seizure of power, a control by men rather than by law of our government. Let us be clear then as to the ultimate purposes of this radical right. Let us look for a moment at its most legitimate exponent, the senator from Arizona, Mr. Goldwater. Mr. Goldwater is next to the president today in the United States, probably the most reported on individual. Whether the issue be trivial, his great approval of college fraternities and sororities as bulwarks of American values, or crucial, his opposition to our backing of the United Nations in Katanga, his views are searched out on every issue, and hardly a day's news passes by without some mention of his view. Mr. Goldwater has crystallized his political views in a little gospel entitled The Conscience of a Conservative. What is his conscience? Is his conscience one sensitive to human need? Is he thirsty with a passion for human justice? Oh no. I'm afraid that at the heart of Mr. Goldwater's conscience there beats the tinkle of a cash register. His greatest virtue, his idol, is the Constitution. He worships every jot and tittle, every comma and period of this document. And his position is simply this. Every law which has been legislated in the United States, which is not precisely permitted by the Constitution, which is not foreseen by this two-century-old document, every bit of such legislation must be voided and annulled. What would this strip from the American scene? It would strip unemployment insurance, Social Security, the income tax, urban renewal, slum clearance, public health, every activity that falls under the office of health, education, and welfare, protection of the union, protection of the consumer. All this must go, must be cast into the garbage pit. Why? Because the Constitution did not specifically foresee its need. How can these laws be part of the legislation of our land if they are unconstitutional? The answer is that the 9 justices of our Supreme Court do not agree with Mr. Goldwater's interpretation of the Constitution. They interpret it not according to its letter, literally, fundamentally, but according to its spirit, its purpose. They have recognized that no document, the Bible, the Constitution, whatever it be, can be limited to its few specifics. It must be understood as a document written in time, with written for a purpose, capable of being interpreted, enlarged on, as long as the spirit which is integral to it is maintained. And if you would understand why a plane coursed above our heads in Cleveland several months ago urging the impeachment of Chief Justice Warren, if you would understand why attacks on the United States Supreme Court feature almost every publication of the extreme right, it lies in this: that our courts have seen that progress, change in America cannot be constricted according to a literal interpretation of this fundamental law. And they have, to the extreme right, sold them out. They look to the court to throw a roadblock across progress. And the court refused to throw that obstacle in the way of progress. And so the court becomes agents of some foreign conspiracy, Soviet dupes. They call for the impeachment of 9 of the finest minds and the most loyal citizens of our nation. Goldwater has little respect for the Supreme Court. It shows in every page of his book. And what of the men and the women whose futures, whose securities will be impaired by the omission, the voiding, the annulling of all of this legislation? What of the farmer who will lose his land and go bankrupt because, price supports having been declared annulled, he cannot receive for his crop enough income to survive? Of this, not one word of pity or compassion. He may apply to the local charity. He should seek employment elsewhere. What of the aged denied their pension check, their Social Security ticket, which allows them to survive? Again, they may apply to a local charity, but his concern is not with them. It is with a marketplace, with a pocketbook, with privilege, not with principle, not with human need, not with the disabled and the infirm and the aged and the unemployed. He speaks to us of a conscience which sees no further than the 4 L's of a bank deposit vault. Oh yes, Senator Goldwater can become rhetorical and passionate. He passionately denounces the graduated rates of income tax payment in the United States. He is prophetic in the tones with which he denounces the laws which insist that a man who makes $1 million must pay a higher rate on this income than the man who makes $10,000. He cannot understand why success should be penalized. On this he rants in the terms of the prophets of old. Here is his passion. Here is his ultimate concern. With privilege, not with principle. With money, not with human beings. Jeremiah the prophet was a conservative. Stand ye in the ways, see which is the old way, that is the good way, and walk therein, for therein shalt thou find peace of mind. Jeremiah the prophet was a conservative, and he was a conservative with a conscience. He was troubled by the injustice and the unrighteousness which he saw about him, by the people of Jerusalem and Judea who would not plead the cause of the fatherless, who were contemptuous of the need of the poor, who were indifferent to the plight of the aged. This troubled him. And in his conscience there burned a passion for the law of Sinai, a law of freedom and the law of justice. Justice, justice shalt thou pursue. And in the name of this older law, he called the people back. He was a conservative of values and of virtues, for in the realm of human virtue, in the realm of human values, one's principles are eternal and unchanging. But with these extreme conservatives of our modern day, we find no such passion for justice. We find no such compassion for human misery. Their conscience, I am afraid, is a rather hard one, indifferent, calloused. They would have us return to an economic jungle, to the days of the 60 and 70 and 80 hour work week. Their concern is that the men of property may be able to acquire more property, not that the men who labor may receive a juster return for their labor. The social legislation which we have adopted in the United States is not perfect. Not all who take advantage of it do so justly, wisely, or with discretion. But it is part of the adventure into a just future which we Americans have undertaken. It is the writing into law of the social gospel which lies at the basis of our Judeo-Christian tradition. It is one of the noblest experiments of mankind. It needs radicals and it needs conservatives. It needs men who are eager to experiment and men who caution that the traditional virtues of person and liberty must be preserved as we experiment. There is room for debate. There is room for being pragmatic. There is room for change. But these of the extreme right are not interested in progress, have no concern with our social vision, have no sympathy with the human elements in this Judeo-Christian tradition. Their concern is the age-old concern with gold and with silver, with getting, with acquiring, with a pocketbook and the bank deposit book. They forget the greatest book of all, the book of our Bible. As we face the new year, these raucous voices will be magnified many times throughout our land. They will appeal to our irritation and to our frustration. They will seek to wave the flag, to raise our passion. They will seek to raise our hackles against certain evidence of racketeering in welfare or some such sin. Let us in the year ahead resolve to keep our balance, resolve to master and to discipline our understanding, resolve to keep America on the middle road, the road of progress, the road of justice, the road of freedom and of liberty, and above all, the road of democracy, which is our future and our hope and the despair of these men. Amen.